Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad.
Produced at the studios of KBOO Radio in Portland, Oregon, this is Prison Pipeline. I'm Doug McVeigh. Advocates nationwide are using remote communications technologies, which have become much more widespread since the pandemic, to help people in prisons testify before legislative committee hearings, public commissions, and agencies. Incarcerated people have been central to developing and passing impactful reforms aimed at ending the use of solitary confinement, ending life without parole, reducing mass incarceration, and more. These testimonies are a powerful reminder that incarcerated people are not voiceless. They have been silenced, but no longer. The Prison Policy Initiative recently held a webinar to discuss these developments and to debut a new part of their advocacy toolkit entitled In Their Own Words, Organizing Legislative Testimony from Incarcerated People. First, here's Emmett Sanders, Policy and Advocacy Associate at the Prison Policy Initiative.
Hi, everyone. I'm Emmett Sanders. I am the Policy and Advocacy Associate here at Prison Policy Initiative. I'm also formerly incarcerated myself, and as someone who has been through the system, I know how important it is for those who have been impacted by it to engage with the people who are making the laws, right? But I also know how often that those voices go unheard, you know, even though that incarcerated people have the most to say. So we'll be talking about that today, about how to get people engaged. So why is this important? Well, system reform is on agendas all over the country, but there are more than a million people in state prisons, just in state prisons alone, who are routinely denied the right to engage with lawmakers, even though these people have more at stake than probably anyone else, right? But more than that, incarcerated voices are powerful. They have changed things. They can change things, and they have changed things. Incarcerated people speaking about the effects of solitary confinement, juvenile life without parole. These are not just stories. These are expert testimony that's being offered, and they're crucial to making actual changes happen. And so why now? Well, the truth is that we can, right? Since COVID-19, the tech exists to better engage people in public functions remotely, right? It's expanded dramatically. 48 states have some form of video calling, often through tablets, and at least 26 state legislatures have some processes for remote participation in one or both chambers. There are definitely problems with this expansion of technology in prisons, but there is also increased opportunity to, again, coordinate, educate, and facilitate testimony from incarcerated people. And we're going to really talk about what it means to facilitate in an ethical way. So coordinating partners first. So first and foremost, incarcerated people are partners in this work, period. They know what needs to change, and they know how the system works. And more importantly, they know what doesn't work, right? They know how to recognize and navigate obstacles in the system that other partners might not even see. And they need to be partners in setting policy agendas from the very beginning, identifying how best to use the limited political capital that we have to make changes and to help educate other folks in prison, but people beyond prison, legislative allies and other people as well. Community-based organizations, great for establishing trust, organizing, the trust that they establish with folks who are in prison because they're working in the communities that folks come from is really important in terms of just making sure that people don't feel left out to dry if something unexpected happens, right? And it's also really important to make sure that you're coordinating across different community-based organizations who are working on these kinds of things. Because you want to make sure that you're not accidentally hurting each other's efforts or stepping on each other's toes, and you're working to coordinate together to make something happen. Legal aid organizations, these allies have access to people in prisons. They can facilitate conversations in ways that, you know, they can open up doors in ways that otherwise is really hard to do. We'll hear from PLS with Jesse from PLS in a minute to talk more about that kind of thing. Allies within the legislature. So they can help organize and prepare people on the inside to give testimony. They help facilitate communication between partners to help overcome logistical hurdles. But allies within the legislature also bring political legitimacy, right? And political connections, which are really important in terms of just getting buy-in from the DOCs. And of course, they draft the laws that incarcerated people are hoping to testify on. So, one word about getting DOC buy-in. The simple truth is that DOCs may or may very well not be partners in these efforts, but they do control access to people in prisons, and they control their access to the tech they need to participate in legislative hearings. So getting buy-in is going to just make things a lot easier. And one thing about this, prison systems generally, they follow from the top down. They're kind of hierarchical bureaucracies. And directors are usually political appointments. So support from legislative allies can be really, really key here in terms of getting buy-in. Next slide, please. So educating, getting people ready to testify in legislative hearings. So incarcerated people need to be fully armed with an understanding of how legislative processes work. They need to have all the information they need to make informed decisions about what's at stake. There are lots of ways to do this, actually. We mentioned tablets earlier. They can be used to make calls and messages, but they can also be used to upload educational materials, information on civic participation, all kinds of things it can be used for. Peer-to-peer educators like Chris and the folks at Look to Justice are really, really important in order to help guide folks through the legislative process. Mail, you can send stuff in, educational materials, surveys, all kinds of things you can send through the mail. It's all in our toolkit. We talk about it there. And collect call blocks. Advocates use collect call blocks where folks can call in from prison with questions they have, blocks of time. It is important, I think, when you're talking about that, really to, make sure that you're scheduling these blocks of time over different days, over different periods of time, just sort of accommodate, scheduling in prison. So that's how we're getting in there and talking to folks. But just a few things about what they should know. You want to make sure that people know what steps are involved in the legislative process. And it can be a little different from place to place. So you'll have to know what it is in your area, right? But how bills are drafted, how they're sponsored, how they're introduced, how legislative committees work, and what it takes to pass legislation. You want to make sure that folks know what's on the table, what's being discussed, what the bills do, how the language might change, for example, or anything during the legislative process. You want to make sure that people are up to date on any kind of developments that happen, right? And that's really important to involve the legislative allies in that, because they can best keep us up to date. You also want to give them an idea of what to expect when they testify, how it's going to work. So make sure that they know, how long they'll have to speak, how to address the committee, like all these things. Make sure just the fundamentals are there, and so they're comfortable enough to speak from their heart, or speak from their experience. And finally, best practices. You need to give some advice on basically how to draft and deliver compelling testimony. Give some tips, some testimony from other folks. You can see here we've shared an example of some tips that PLS Massachusetts here have shared with us, and it is in our toolkit as well, and you'll find that online. So one of the most important things to make sure that people know when you're putting this forward is just that there are things that they're going to have to, you need to communicate what kind of risk that people are facing, because they might not want to testify if they know what they're up against, and so people have to make an informed decision. This has to come from them. So victims advocacy groups might offer opposing testimony. That's something they might have to encounter. You might see opposition from COs unions, citing security. And those of us who've been incarcerated know security is often used as a blanket excuse, to sort of shut down a lot of things. Prison administration might put in restrictions about how many people can testify or who can and can't testify, or limit communication or movement. And there's also a potential for impact on open cases. So incarcerated people who want to testify really need to speak with their lawyers and make sure that it's okay, you know, that there's nothing untoward that's going to happen. And just a word on retaliation. People in prison face retaliation for speaking out about their conditions all the time. And that's a truth. And it can be really hard to prove or connect it back to testimony, because a lot of that retaliation can look like just everyday prison things that we deal with in there, right? So it can look like shakedowns or transfers or tickets, just anything. And so that's something that we have to keep in mind as well. The single most important thing here is to make sure that people are fully aware that these are possibilities, and to be very, very clear about what you can do and what you can't do for them, right? But also getting buy-in from the Department of Corrections administration, like I mentioned earlier, can be really useful in countering or preempting retaliation and obstruction. So make sure to keep open lines of communication with folks throughout the entire process, you know, before, during, and especially after, right? So they don't feel like they're left out, left alone, and document any kind of retaliation that they might face. So facilitation. Facilitation means following, right? How can we expect lawmakers or anyone else to listen to incarcerated folks if we aren't listening to them ourselves? Advocates leverage their power to create opportunities for others to leverage theirs. This means making sure that incarcerated people are involved as much as possible from the very beginning, including when deciding what bills to actually help them submit testimony on, right? And it also means making sure that you're getting a comprehensive consensus across the demographics in prison. Incarcerated people are not a monolithic entity, right? We are not one person. So you need to make sure that you're talking to folks in different demographics and different prisons to get a full range of input when you're deciding what to actually pursue and how to engage. So these are just a couple of things real quick we'll touch on, just common arguments that come up and some few useful responses. The tech doesn't exist. Well, actually, as we mentioned, it does, right? Video calling is expanding from like 15 states in 2015 to like almost every state by now. But if it doesn't, you know, people can still submit written testimony like they did in Connecticut on bills that was very successful, or have it read into record. Scheduling is too difficult. Ask legislative allies to push committees for accommodations like scheduling hearings earlier in the day or splitting up multiple bills and multiple hearings or multiple days, or to take testimony out of order, you know, to be flexible enough to accommodate people who need to speak. And we can't let everyone speak. There may be restrictions on time or the number of speakers or something like that, but just make sure the potential testifiers know that this is possible, so they're prepared if it happens, so they're not caught off guard. And help them to develop written testimony to sort of submit if they don't get called. You can also do like PLS did, which was to encourage the people who don't get to testify get to sit in the room with people who do in order to support them and show support. And finally, you can't speak with people in solitary. Well, if we're not talking with people in solitary confinement about what solitary confinement is like, then we're not really doing it, right? So representation really matters here. And so advocates need to really stress to stakeholders that the importance of representation, and, you know, that means speaking with people who are sentenced to long, long, lengthy sentences, or people at high security levels, and people in solitary confinement. That's important and it matters.
That was Emmett Sanders, Policy and Advocacy Associate at the Prison Policy Initiative, speaking on a webinar entitled, In Their Own Words, Organizing Legislative Testimony from Incarcerated People. We'll hear more in a moment. You're listening to Prison Pipeline. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Jesse White is the Legislative Director at Prisoners Legal Services of Massachusetts.
PLS is a legal services organization, so we do individual and systemic advocacy work. We do impact litigation, and we do policy work, all sort of in our toolbox at PLS. But one thing that we try to center in everything that we do is our clients' leadership and our clients' partnership. So in the policy team, we're meeting regularly with incarcerated people, with authorized groups that are permitted in the Massachusetts prison system, to talk about what people's priorities are, what kind of strategies people think should be being utilized to meet the goals that are being identified, and then also to help build knowledge around the legislative process more generally and about the political landscape and how it all works. So, you know, how we came to be involved in the work of facilitating incarcerated people's testimony in these hearings is, I think, like most of the, you know, most powerful movement work that happens, we really followed the lead of our clients, of incarcerated people, and we followed the lead of grassroots organizers. So, you know, this past legislative session was the first session where incarcerated people were permitted to testify directly via video call technology, but it wasn't the first session that we've been advocating for that. And it wasn't the first session that incarcerated people have been advocating for that. So, I mean, incarcerated people and allied advocates and grassroots partners have been trying to facilitate incarcerated participation in these hearings for quite some time. And we've found alternative ways to do it before folks were allowed to testify directly. So people would submit written testimony. We would, advocates and allies would read out testimony from incarcerated people where that was permitted by the committee. And believe it or not, sometimes that was not permitted by the committees. And we worked really closely with legislative partners as well to make sure that they were meeting with incarcerated people, going into the prisons, speaking with people directly, even outside of the hearing process. But really, it was the advent, or I should say the expansion of video call technology during COVID, that led to us being able to successfully advocate for direct participation of incarcerated people. Prior to that, of course, the Department of Correction would, you know, say that it's not possible to bring folks to the state house, security needs, all of that. But that's a really hard position to keep when you're talking about video call technology. When these hearings are happening in a hybrid way, some of that, you know, happening fully remote during COVID and then transitioning to a hybrid system, there's really no reason why incarcerated people shouldn't be able to tap into that, and why the democratic process shouldn't become more accessible. And that accessibility benefits everyone. It benefits incarcerated people. It benefits people with disabilities that need access in alternative ways and need accommodations. It benefits people's communities who want to hear from people directly. And it benefits legislators to be able to hear from the people that are closest to the problems. So it's really a powerful thing, and is really important to us to make sure that we were making it happen. So, you know, it started really with grassroots partners successfully advocating for the participation of people incarcerated in our women's prison to testify about a prison and jail construction moratorium. And then we were able to work with those grassroots partners to build and expand on that. And at the end of the day, we ended up with around 90 incarcerated people testifying from, I think, 7 different state prisons on over a dozen different bills before 3 different legislative committees. So it was really a rousing success, and we intend to continue building upon it going forward. And I think, like Anthony and Chris both touched on, you know, the testimony is just one component. Building the knowledge, building the education, building consensus, you know, is a huge part as well. So we put together tons of informational materials to share with people. We met with incarcerated people and with leaders of incarcerated people's organizations throughout the session to talk about what people needed to be supported in the process and how we could try to facilitate that with our knowledge of the state house and the political process. And we really just tried to focus on democratizing the political process, which is supposed to be a democracy anyway. So we're really trying to get at that as we did this work.
That was Jesse White, Legislative Director at Prisoners Legal Services of Massachusetts, speaking on a webinar sponsored by the Prison Policy Initiative entitled In Their Own Words, Organizing Legislative Testimony from Incarcerated People. Christopher Blackwell is an award-winning journalist currently incarcerated at the Washington Corrections Center and a board member and co-founder of the organization Look to Justice.
Well, one, thank you for everybody for being here, and thank you for, you know, for us being able to come here and talk to you guys. It's definitely a privilege to do this as we talk about the work about leading and empowering incarcerated voices. As Emmett said, that, you know, I'm currently incarcerated. I've been incarcerated for 21 years. You know, my wife and I started Look to Justice in 2020 as we seen like a need for a way to empower incarcerated voices in a lot of the work that we were doing. We wanted to see people at the head of the table when we were talking about legislation, what that legislation looked like, you know, what's a consent, right? Who decides where we consent on a piece of legislation? Is it someone that's at home, that is comfortable in their house and doesn't have to make that sacrifice, or should that consent be made by the person who is currently incarcerated and ultimately has to make that sacrifice? So, you know, because of that and because of the work we were doing, me and my wife, Dr. Chelsea Moore, you know, decided like, hey, let's like build something out that can be led by incarcerated people and, you know, people on the outside in coalition with formerly incarcerated and impacted family members and community members that just really wanted to work and fight for the things that we wanted to see from us and our communities. So we started our org. Things were a little rocky at first, of course, as, you know, doing all organizational work is, and really just kind of getting started and figuring out a nonprofit. You know, and then we kind of decided like what we wanted to do first. First, we wanted a newsletter. We wanted to start a newsletter in the prison that went to as many prisoners as possible to inform people what was going on. We wanted to also use that newsletter and that base to do surveys so we could see what people actually wanted and just kind of have a better idea of not just the few like voices that had a platform deciding what people wanted, but actually the larger portion of the incarcerated population. So once we kind of started to build that out, which has been extremely successful, today we have, you know, over 20% of Washington State's prison system currently on our newsletter, which is thousands of people. We also built out, how do we build the next set of leaders? And the next set of leaders was our lead organizers. So we wanted to build and get a group of people at each prison across the state in the main hub prisons, which in our state there's 8, and we wanted to empower them to essentially work closely with us so we could see as they're working on the ground with that population of individuals in their community, what was needed, what was wanted, what questions come up, how can we do better? So we set that up and currently have 12 lead organizers across the state that are also doing that work. And then we also wanted to stay true to what we're saying, right? Like if we're saying we're being led by incarcerated people, then we need to put people like that in a lead. And when we're asking for funders to do this, like we need to explain to them what that means, because it's not something that we see. It's not often that someone is an executive director of an organization the size of ours, you know, that's currently incarcerated. And I'm not the only one that we want to have in these kinds of positions, you know. So we also hired a director for inside organizing, right? And then we wanted to make sure, like, that we pay people and we treat people fairly. Like, this is the work and the creative work and, you know, the stressful work that we do. If we were doing it on the outside, we wanted to be treated, our organization treating people just like we would if they were on the outside doing this work. So after doing that and kind of building out our structure, you know, we decided, aside from the information, how do we get people better engaged? So we started to do our trainings around things like testifying. That was one of the first things we did, is we started to work to get people able to testify. Emmett is definitely right. It is a lot easier when the DOC is on board. Unfortunately, that is a very difficult thing to do at times, especially when you're a grassroots organization, and especially when you have a lot of the people that work with your organization that are incarcerated. Because it's always kind of seen as a threat. At least that's what we've experienced in our state. So what we did is we started teaching people how to do this, how to testify. We got legislators to reach out. We built strong relationships with legislators and policy actors to reach out on our behalf to ask for certain incarcerated individuals to testify. And then when we were able to get them, we sat and worked with people on what's the best way to tell your story in 2 minutes, right? You might only have a minute and a half to 2 minutes before you get cut off in a legislative hearing. So how do you get the most impact? how do you get what you really need to get across in that for legislators to hear before they make decisions on the policies that we want to see, right? And like getting our voice so what we want to see is actually at the forefront. So we felt really strong about that. We were able to do that really well. And then we kind of led that out to outside people, right? Like we can train people inside, but it's how do we get our families involved? How do we get our networks involved? So then we started thinking about other ways to do like advocacy 101 trainings where we would train people on the inside and do a lot of trainings on the inside with our lead organizers and large groups of the prison population, but then also mirror that out in the community with the organizers that we've hired out there to do their trainings with family members in impacted communities so they could also have the same knowledge and be able to come to the forefront of the work, because it's important that not only those of us inside are able to do this work, but it's important that we also have that availability for our family members and that they have that knowledge and know-how. You know, how to write a legislator, that was another thing that we really focused on. How do you connect with your legislator? Getting incarcerated people to realize that you're a constituent of a legislator from wherever it was that you fell and your crime happened, right? That you would continue to correspond or reach out to your legislator as a constituent for what you want to see. And then, of course, after that, like we started thinking, well, how do we get this on the front end, right? Myself, I entered the system at 12 years old for the first time and did my first year of incarceration at 12. And I think about the fact that I had never seen a legislator in my community. I had never seen a legislator in my schools. I didn't even know what a legislator was until I was in my late 20s. So then we started to do work in schools, and now we're doing advocacy trainings in the schools. We're doing mock legislative sessions in the schools to teach kids and impact the communities about their voice, the empowerment of their voice, and how do they get involved in using their voice. And then, of course, we do a lot of community building, right? Like, doing this work is hard. It's, you know, we're dealing with a lot of trauma in these spaces, a lot of distrust. You know, we're coming from impacted communities that have suffered from a lot of harm. So we got to take time to build those relationships. We got to take that time to get to know each other. And it's also important that policy actors and other people that are involved in these spaces take that time to get involved. So, you know, we hold like big community barbecues, and we just had one, right? And we encourage people to bring their kids and everything. So the last one we had a couple of weeks ago, you know, there was a bunch of Superior Court judges there, and they all had their kids there. In the same space is a whole bunch of formerly incarcerated people that were incarcerated for serious violent crimes, right? And they're working together, they're sharing a meal together, they're humanizing each other. You know, and I think that that's one of the biggest things and the hurdles to this work when we do it. We have all the data, we have all the numbers, we know the racial disparities that are going on, we know who's being targeted and harmed. But the most important thing is that we can humanize the individuals that are suffering from that, so we can get policy people and legislators to start to understand the mitigating factors that lead us to cause harm and commit crimes, and also how do we get out of that? What is needed to get out of that? You know, and then that has also spiraled into us doing a lot of writing campaigns, sharing stories, storytelling, and writing.
That was Christopher Blackwell, an award-winning journalist currently incarcerated at the Washington Correction Center and a board member and co-founder of the organization Look to Justice, speaking on a webinar sponsored by the Prison Policy Initiative entitled In Their Own Words, Organizing Legislative Testimony from Incarcerated People. For now, that's it. Thank you for joining us. You've been listening to Prison Pipeline. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. Join us again next week for another edition of Prison Pipeline. For now, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long!